According to Adam Gopnik, not since the early 20th century has liberalism and liberals been under such relentless attack from both right and left. The crisis of democracy in our era has produced a crisis of faith in liberal institutions and, even worse, in liberal thought. His new book, A Thousand Small Sanities, is a manifesto rooted in the lives of people who invented and extended the liberal tradition. He argues that liberalism is not a form of centrism, nor simply another word for free markets, nor merely a term denoting a set of rights. It is something far more ambitious, the search for radical change by humane measures. Adam Gopnik is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He has written for the magazine since 1986. He is the author of numerous best-selling books, including Paris to the Moon, the latest, just out in paperback, A Thousand Small Sanities. We welcome Adam Gopnik back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Delighted to be back, Joe.
Thank you very much. So what brought you initially, given that the book it came out in hardcover last year, of what brought you initially to this topic?
Well, immediately speaking, it was that my daughter, who was then 17 years old, was so shaken by the results of the election in 2016 that I took her out for a long walk on that election night to try and reassure her that the world was not coming to an end and liberal democracy was not on the brink of extinction. And of course, like every father trying to reassure a 17-year-old daughter, I failed completely. So having failed on election night, I decided to write her a long letter about liberalism and its future and its meanings. And what I wanted to do, Joe, very much as you were saying, was to make her understand that the things we call liberal democracy, liberal humanism, that set of beliefs that I had promoted, I had in a sense instructed her in, were not kind of narrow technocratic beliefs in the management of society, but that they were powerful moral ideas about the possibility of social transformation through incremental measures and through the process of persuasion.
So in the book where you talk about a free press and debate and open universities, all of this seems to be even under more attack now than it was a year ago. So obviously that was not part of the plan, but were you surprised by that?
I won't pretend that I'm not deeply worried, frightened, depressed, choose your word, by everything that's happened. We've never before seen such authoritarian gestures by an American president, so hostile to not just the norms, as we sometimes say, but to the basic premises of liberal democracy, respect for free press, for instance, calling the press the enemy of the people. That's something only totalitarian and authoritarian tyrants have ever done before. So yes, that part of it is very frightening. What I try to do in the book, and I even have a new afterword underlining this, is to talk about how what matters most are not just the institutions of liberal democracy, elections, and the rule of law, vital though those are, but the broader run of what we might call liberal institutions, what academics sometimes call social capital. They mean things like universities. They mean things like clubs. They mean all of the voluntary associations we take part in that teach us to get along, for better or ill, with people who are not necessarily of our clan or not necessarily of our kind. And those institutions are the key in lots of ways, Joe, to making democracy work. If we have strong social institutions, then the rest of it can happen. Even markets depend on our having a strong level of social capital, of institutions that promote social sympathy and trust. So my hope is that by protecting those institutions, they include things like the conversation you and I are having right now without impediments. We're not frightened that the secret police are listening to us yet. They include things like magazines and newspapers, that we can strengthen those institutions as well as a way of strengthening liberal democracy in a broader sense.
This wasn't going to be my next question until you said the word secret police, but we're seeing that now of what many would refer to as secret police coming into our cities like Portland and soon to be Chicago. Yep. I mean, this just goes right into what you were just saying, doesn't it?
Totally. It's terrifying, exactly because those are the kinds of things, finally, when we begin down that slope in which unidentified uniformed folks are intervening in American cities is extremely frightening. Those are the steps by which authoritarianism proceeds. And even worse, in a sense, Joe, what always happens, and this is part of the evil incrementalism of the totalitarian mind, is that you get this terrible kind of shrugging and step-by-step acceptance. You know, things that become, to use that awful word, normalized, that would themselves have been an unacceptable scandal a mere year ago, or much less 4 years ago. And that goes on and on. President Trump's habit, for instance, of constantly criminalizing his predecessors. We accept that now when he makes these wild charges that Obama and Biden spied on them, that they should be in prison. Those are the kinds of things that in the past only happened in corrupt third world dictatorships. So we are right to be very frightened when we ask ourselves, how are we going to protect liberal democracy? The answer is in part, obviously, through elections, and that's in some ways the most vital part, but it's also through protecting and sustaining all of the other kinds of institutions that enable us to deal with each other in honest and sympathetic ways.
It seems to me, and I have not gotten a clear answer on this, but when these people are on the streets of Portland, let's say, and they are protesting, and an unmarked car comes up, and people in with camouflage take them into the car, what is happening to these people? What first of all, what sin have they committed, and then what is being done to them?
Well, from what I've read, and I've been trying to follow the story, Portland is one of my favorite cities in North America. Back before the pandemic, I spent a lot of time on the road, and it was a place I would rather get to than Portland, because though all the Portlandians will tell you it's been ruined, it still is a city of great eccentric radicalism on many fronts, from wine to politics. So it's a city I love, and what I can gather is that folks are being detained and then released, but of course all of this designed to create an aura of intimidation. And what's really going on, if you want my point of view, is that it's being done to provoke by Trump and his minions, to provoke violence so that they can take pictures of it and frighten people in Wisconsin and Michigan, that it's part of the reality show insanity of the current administration. They're deliberately trying to provoke shows of photogenic violence in order to frighten people. And I think that's a large part of what's going on. I would hope that someone like Governor Cuomo here in New York would say in a forthright way that it would be unacceptable in New York. You don't have a right to kidnap people if you're an unidentified officer of any group. That's not the way things work under the rule of law. So I feel it's frightening, and I think it's one of those places exactly where we can't shrug and accept and say, well, they're not shooting people down in the street. That's not the point.
What is it about the liberal traditions that you write about that are so misunderstood? Why are they so misunderstood?
I think two things come in. One is you mentioned at the beginning, and that is what I think of as the myth of centrism, the idea that liberals and the liberal tradition are always trying to split every difference, or always are willing to be both-siders. There's good on both sides. Sometimes there is, but often there isn't. Centrism, that is what we call centrism, is a function of pluralism. But what do I mean by that? Look, there's lots of changes that I would be passionately eager to see made tomorrow morning. I've spent a large part of my life the past decade writing about gun control and about ending gun massacres. And I would love tomorrow morning for us to have gun laws like the gun laws in Canada, where I come from, Australia, or Great Britain. But I accept that that's not something I'm going to be able to achieve overnight. It's going to be a very long, hard struggle of persuasion, of change, of demonstration, all of the things that are necessary. So when liberals talk about the virtues of incrementalism, it's not because they believe that incrementalism is good in itself. It's because they accept that we live necessarily in a highly pluralistic society, and part of the necessity of respecting that kind of pluralism is respecting politics and recognizing that often change will take place slowly and yet will take place. You know, we've lived through, Joe, some of the biggest social changes in the history of mankind. Think about something like gay marriage, for instance. That's never been a social institution anywhere except the Western world, the United States, in the past 20 years. And that was achieved exactly through the process of liberal persuasion, a respectful pluralism, and the ultimate outcome that if you persuade enough people, even onto the Supreme Court, change takes place.
And
radical change. And yet,
that radical change can also be turned back. And I think that's what we're seeing over and over, which is also equally frightening. It's that you win a day, and then it's the old saying of, you know, one step forward, three steps back.
Well, I would be inclined to say, yes, it's one step forward and one step back, but never entirely back. It's more like two steps forward, one step back. If you think about all of the civil liberties and all of the human rights that we have fought for and on the whole won in the last 50 years in America, many of them of a kind that, as I say, have never before been achieved by societies. They are, for the moment at least, still in place. Do we have to fight for them every day? Of course. That's part of our commitment as citizens, is to go on fighting for them all the time. But liberal institutions are extremely powerful in reform and in making change happen. They're also extremely fragile. And we're in the constant battle of protecting them from the authoritarian impulses of the right and from the totalitarian temptations of the left. And that is an unending battle that has been going on for as long as people have had a dream of reforming society, and I have no belief that it's likely to stop soon. What I'm trying to do in this book, what I was trying to do in my long letter to Olivia, my daughter, was to tell her something about the lives of the men and women who have in the past embraced that idea of reform through reason and show her what heroic people they were.
Adam Gopnik's new book is 1,000 Small Sanities. It is just out in paperback. We always say this, it seems like we always say this, that this is the most important election of our time, the election that's coming up. But this really does seem to be just a hugely important, because all of the things that you talk about in this book, as we talked about the fragility a moment ago, can just go smashing away, can't they?
You're right that we often say foolishly, oh, this is the most important election of our lifetime. Not always. I don't think anyone imagined that the presidential election, say, of 1996 or even of 2000 would be the most vital elections. The world was, relatively speaking, placid and prosperous at that point. But I think that this is, yes, indeed, the most important American election since 1864, since Lincoln's reelection during the Civil War, when the whole country might have gone in the other direction. I think that, yes, I will say bluntly, that a Trump victory would mark the beginning of the end of American democracy. I think that the authoritarian pattern that he clearly relishes in his own chaotic way would begin to become stronger and stronger. We've never had a more important election. I think that's true. But the only thing I would add to that is that elections are vital, but elections are not everything. That at the same time, we have to be struggling to protect all of the other liberal institutions in our society, like the conversation we're having right now, like the free press, like the open university, like the unimpeded sharing of information, like the protection of institutions of justice from being corrupted and prostituted by power. All of those things are hugely important, too. And where those institutions are strong, it's very hard for tyranny to assert itself. Where those institutions become demoralized, the tyrant wins.
You have touched on much of this, but I'm just hoping to focus in, because you make the point that given the importance of this election, that liberals need to be armed with the right ideas to fight it. So what are those right ideas?
The right ideas are, first of all, a belief that coalition and compromise are not sad words, or much less evil words, but are hugely positive and heroic words. We have to build the broadest possible coalition of people who may disagree about questions of taxes and health care and other things, but who are all equally persuaded of the importance of sustaining liberal democracy and liberal institutions. We can disagree about a million things as long as we agree about the one vital thing. So coalition is important. Compromise is important as well. The idea that we cannot have it all our own way, but that we will advance our ideas by putting them forward. There's nothing wrong with compromise. Compromise is a heroic thing. It's a way of tying a knot tight between conflicting certainties. So believing in coalition, believing in compromise, believing in what the great Bayard Rustin, one of the forgotten but heroic figures of the civil rights movement, called the three dance steps of democratic change: democratic measures, constitutional procedures, and nonviolent processes. We believe in those things, and if we continue to pursue them and pursue the right to protest, then I think that we can not only win something meaningful. And what fills me with despair is whenever people are suspicious of coalition as somehow weakening the cause, whenever they're suspicious of compromise as somehow leeching away our values. And on the contrary, we have to build the broadest possible front we can of people who share those essential beliefs.
So it was Rustin who said nonviolent tactics, constitutional means, democratic procedures.
Exactly.
Are we seeing that in the current crop of protests across this country?
I think we are, on the whole, and it's been one of the easily overlooked but enormously cheering developments. You know, there have been moments of violence and moments of brief interludes of looting, but on the whole, this wave of protests that we've been living through have been remarkably broadly based. They've been remarkably nonviolent. They've been remarkably clear. The thing that I think we have to move from is from simply being a protest to policy. You know, there's nothing demeaning about saying, okay, we've protested. In some sense, we've won. What are the specific policies that we want? Because that's where politics are. And that's another thing we need to do, is revive the notion that politics are virtuous. Politics are good. They're exactly the way that protest gets translated into policy. Protest can only be translated into policy by politics. And we have to start thinking specifically and pragmatically about what changes we want in policing. Saying defund the police is clearly a very bad idea because it's hugely unpopular. But having the specific policies that will reduce the militarization of policing, that will help end the mass incarceration of Americans, those things can be achieved, and those are the things that politics make possible.
I read your book a year ago when it first came out, and now that it's out in paperback, I spent the weekend just refamiliarizing myself and getting ready for this interview. But as I was reading it, of course, it was just seemed to be, as I was also trying to process the death of John Lewis, who seemed to just embody so much of what you write about.
Yes, John Lewis did, just as Bayard Rustin did. One of the great things in which we should try and draw inspiration is that the heroes of the civil rights movement, among the most heroic figures in all of our history, did all embody liberalism as I understand it, a total commitment to nonviolent means, a total commitment to the broadest possible plural coalition. That's how they worked. That's the people who came out on the marches, but not out of a desire for the middle way, not out of a desire for a mediocrity in social change. They believed that it was possible to have radical change through humane measures. And John Lewis lived that his whole life. That's why he went from Selma Bridge to the halls of Congress. Those are inspiring figures, and I think that they represent the glowing side of American liberalism.
My final question to you is one that I guess is what we're all looking for when it comes to this election. Do you think that Joe Biden is a good man to bring us and bring us back to many of these liberal traditions?
Look, I think that Joe Biden is obviously a fine human being. He has a long, long record. There are things on it we admire, things we admire less. But one of the lessons of the history of liberal democracies is that we don't need heroes. We just need good people. That's one of the strengths of liberalism. It's not looking for the Messiah. It's not looking for a man on a horseback. It's looking for rational, intelligent people who can address specific problems in a pragmatic way that honors politics rather than denigrating it. So I think that in that sense, Biden has many of those virtues. And when we look at the long history of people who have really made change, they're very rarely heroic figures. They're often figures like someone like Clement Attlee, the great Labour prime minister in Britain, who was in coalition with Churchill throughout the war and then defeated him and then brought in the National Health Service and all of the positive things of that great social democratic transformation. So I'm not looking for a hero, Joe. I don't think we need a hero. We need good people, good men and women. And part of the strength of liberal democracy is that it relies far more on recognizing the virtue and the potential in every decent human being, rather than searching the skies for some messiah who will bring us a utopia, because that we know we will never have.
Beautifully said. The name of the new book, out in paperback from Basic Books, is A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. Adam Gopnik, it's always a pleasure to have you before our microphones. I thank you very much for being with us.
I was delighted to be with you, Joe. Let's do it again.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Again, Adam Gopnik's new book is A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.